This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
As a woman, do you feel safe exercising on your own? Walking in the dark? Would you go for a walk or a run through bushland? Would you camp on your own? As women, we want the right to feel safe to do all of these things. Yet many of us don't because we fear for our safety. We worry that we'll be assaulted. So when you do find the courage and you do something like hike and camp alone, and then your worst fears come true. A man jumps out of the bushes and tries to assault you. You manage to get away and call the police, only to be told that nothing can be done. It takes a social media post to create change. So how far have we come? In just a moment, you will meet the woman that this happened to. And also this hour, Sir Roy Grounds, the architect behind the National Gallery of Victoria and the Arts Centre, he also designed a building at Melbourne University. But it might be pulled down.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So Sarah started bushwalking in central Victoria just last year, and she decided to document the entire process to try and inspire other women to take it up. But something stopped her in her tracks. Sarah Gibbs, a warm welcome to The Conversation Hour.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Sarah, so you decided to take up bushwalking because you were inspired by another woman. What happened?
Yeah, I was at the Alpines and I was only doing day hikes at that time, and I noticed this older woman, 60 years old, and she had this big backpack on, and she told me that she would be doing 26 kilometres today and then another 26 tomorrow to Mount Hotham. And I thought, I want to do something like that, and I want to document it to show women that, you know, we can do this. You just got to give it a shot.
So your first big camping hike, this was huge, right? So tell us about your first big trip.
Yeah, so I decided to do a really easy trail, which is the Goldfields Track, 222 kilometres from Bendigo to Mount Buninyong. It took me 9 days and 60 hours of walking time.
So at about 160 k's into your track, you were sort of nearing Daylesford. What happened?
So I was walking along a single lane track and I stopped at the Mineral Springs for a bit of a break, and I noticed this man run behind me down the single lane track, and every fibre of my being just went, this is so not good. Mm. I got such a bad vibe, and then I started filming, and he was touching me all over, suggesting sex, and I am very thankful that I was very close to Daylesford Lake, where I was able to flag people down and call the police and sort of try and get this guy off the track, because there were lots of single mums, lots of people hiking around the area at the time.
Sarah, I'm so sorry that that happened to you. Every hair on my body is standing up at the moment because these are our worst fears. So what happened? How, you were still a fair way from the campsite. How did you manage to get away from him?
The way that I did it was I played it really cool. I'm answering all his questions. I'm kind of nodding, being, you know, the good conditioned, good girl, not trying to arc him up or anything. And then as I start really power walking towards Lake Daylesford, he sees a campsite and like beelines to rummage through that campsite. And that was my golden ticket to really divert and head to Lake Daylesford.
So what did you do then?
And then I I thought about it for about 10 minutes and I decided, no, I've got to call the police.
Oh,
this guy's still down there. And I called the police and they said, I've got to make a house call, but I'll be there in about 3 hours or so. Are you going to hang around? And I went, well, no. Like, I'm at the vicinity where this guy assaulted me at. And, yeah, 3 hours later, I said, yeah, come find me at the pub in Dalston.
Were you shocked or surprised by the reaction that you got? Did you feel like you were believed?
Essentially, no. Because on the footage, we're watching it in front of the pub. There's trucks, there's people everywhere. You have to really listen closely to hear what he's saying. And with the footage that I have, I've got the phone beside me walking, so he didn't see the phone. And, I really felt like I was sort of wasting their time in a sense.
Sarah Gibbs is with you, a bushwalker who was assaulted whilst she was bushwalking. Sarah, given that you'd already been documenting this entire process, you then went to social media and others have come out since then that say that they believe they've been assaulted by the same person, and we don't want to get into the details of that. However, did that then spark change from the police?
Yes, it did. So I said to the police, I said, you know, is this guy, does he camp in the bush regularly? Like, who is he? Like, where does he live? Because tomorrow morning I have to go back on that exact same trail at that exact same spot because I'm doing the Goldfields track. And then I said to the police, can you at least tell him to keep away from the track just so I can move on? And the cop said, we can't really do that. And that's when I posted on Dalesford Facebook page and said, who is this guy? Where is he? Purely for my own safety.
So it didn't make you stop hiking?
No, I wasn't going to let this guy create a trauma where I would avoid doing the one thing that I love in this world. I got a few phone calls saying, do you want us to come pick you up? Like, have you finished? And I went, no chance. I'll be back on that track first thing at sunlight and I'm going to complete this and then show women do not let these people win.
Sarah, thank you for speaking so openly and honestly. And I know you've spoken to my colleague Eden Henninen, who is a reporter with the ABC, and she has documented your story and it's up on the website so people can go to the ABC website to read the story that Eden has put together. Are you okay, Sarah? Sometimes it takes a little while for the shock and for the trauma to kick in. Are you feeling okay?
I mean, that's what exactly happened. You know, as soon as I kept walking and hit Creswick, it kind of dawned on me that, I was incredibly lucky to be even standing here speaking, where there's other women who aren't as lucky to be walking out of the bush the way I did. And as an Australian woman, I'm really sick of these close calls where the police don't really take us seriously.
Sarah, thank you. We're going to have a chat to 1-800-2-RESPECT in just a moment because I dare say they will be singing the exact same song. Sarah, thank you so much. Appreciate your story and your honesty.
Cool. Thank you for having me.
Sarah Gibbs, who's a bushwalker. You can see Sarah and you can read her story that's been produced by Eden Henninen on the ABC's website. Helen Bolton is the CEO of Respect. Helen, texts like this are coming in. The same thing happened to me. Walking home one night, a guy jumped out of the bush. I rang 000. Police came. They didn't believe me and they just drove off. They told me I was wasting their time. And another that says, as a woman, I totally agree, Rish, but as a mother of two sons, I always advise them not to go to lonely places alone either. That's from Jenny. Does it take for something to happen to someone like Sarah before the reports are taken seriously and before police have the authority or the will to do anything?
Good morning, Rochelle. And firstly, I'd like to just express to Sarah just how incredibly brave and resilient she is, but how sorry I am. That is a really horrific and traumatic experience, and often far too common for women in our society. So, it is really distressing to listen to. And as you're saying, we're hearing a lot of other women expressing the same experience that has occurred.
What will it take, what will it take for one woman's account to be enough, that it doesn't have to be multiple, that Sarah doesn't have to be physically hurt in order for her story, and Sarah can be any of us, to be listened to and to be believed? When is one woman's story enough?
One woman's story is enough. It's, it's more than enough, and it should not happen. So we do need to take women's accounts of their experience of violence, sexual harassment, sexual assault seriously. We need our justice system to also listen and believe and take action. Believing and supporting survivors of gendered violence is essential, and it's essential to that individual's ability to heal, to seek justice, and it's crucial to preventing violence more generally. Respect Victoria is Victoria's primary prevention agency. We're working with the Ballarat community, and that's quite close to Daylesford.
Of course.
Around a community mobilisation initiative that the community is leading. They've had, a very tragic and sad history of violence against women, but they're an incredibly proud and resilient community. And the whole community is saying, not in our, our city, not in our town, and are doing work with schools, with children in early childhood settings, with workplaces around primary prevention, around educating people in that community that gendered violence is not okay, that the drivers are gender inequality, rigid gender role models, condoning disrespectful or violent behaviour. We know community attitudes are the foundation of gendered violence. Violence occurs in a social construct, and you need to be able to address that socially in a community by addressing those issues. So one woman's story is
absolutely
enough for action to
and
happen.
Time and time again, Helen Bolton, the CEO of Respect, is with you, that one woman's account, one woman's call to a police station needs to be enough, so that, because often we hear, well, there was a history, that there was a behaviour from a certain person, from the perpetrator, that there was a pattern, that it happened over time and it escalated over time. So to be able to get in early and to look and to work with prevention, and potentially, as confrontational as it is, to work with the perpetrator.
Absolutely. That's so important that we have appropriate programs and interventions for people who choose to use violence. Those behaviours are a choice that someone consciously makes. Every woman, every victim has a right to live free without violence, without assault, without harassment. And we need, institutions and structures who play a really important role in communicating to victims that what happened to them is wrong, that it's not their fault, not their responsibility. And we heard from Sarah, how she really cleverly pacified and, had a survival instinct.
I know.
The mechanisms that she described to stay safe. As women, we know what she went through. We know how she acted that out.
God, and you feel sick, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. And, incredibly smart. But women should not have to do this. Like, we should not have to live in fear. We should not have our rights impinged upon. How incredible for a young woman to do such an, a strong hike. Like, what an achievement in her life. And to have that violated is just unacceptable. And the community is now saying, as you would see, on social media, it is not acceptable, and we need more prevention, more community mobilisation, and, first responders who play that really important role to take action.
While we have you, Helen, I want to have a chat to Rita, who's called through. Good morning, Rita.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Really well. What did you want to share?
So this was many years ago, and I was at university, broad daylight, and I was just walking along an outdoor corridor. I had three tall guys come from behind me. I didn't see them or hear them, and they ferociously groped me on my backside from behind. I confronted them, and then they started calling me crazy and asking me if I was on drugs, and I said, well, I'm calling the police, which I did. Then they started to move on, and I police said, can you follow them so we know exactly where they're going? I said, I don't feel comfortable doing that. The following day, I went to do a report at the police station, and the officer was leaning against his chair when I went in to make, you know, a report. And when I explained what happened, and he laughed and said, oh, so you're here to make a report because someone touched your bottom? To which I replied, what do you find so funny about this? Like, seriously, I mean, what do you find so funny? And then he took me seriously, and I did express my distaste towards him. And I didn't end up doing a report. I walked away, and it just brought to mind how so many of us don't make reports. Because, you know, we feel like unless we are actually, whether it's, you know, raped in some way, you know, like physically and pinned down and, you know, almost killed, that none of this gets taken seriously. But it was clearly a violation. Oh, I can see them coming. Who knows?
I know, and this is the thing. It takes for you to actually be, I mean, that is enough to report. Of course, it is a violation and it's disgusting. However, you should not... It should not have to escalate for that to be taken seriously. Helen Bolton, has anything changed and has any progress been occurred when it comes to how police deal with things like what Rita has just said?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Victoria Police have done a lot of work around their response to family and sexual violence, and there are specialist units now, the Sexual Offences Team, the Family Violence Investigation Unit, they've got a Family Violence Academy. They are doing a lot of work, and attitudes and responses are changing in the right way. You know, it's important that men show solidarity with women and stand up and call out behaviour that they see from other men and their mates that, you know, the kind of indicators of the early formed attitudes that are the kind of foundations of violence against women. Jokes about women are not okay.
No, that's right. And then there's the emotional impact as well. So then you walk away, right, Rita, and again, any of us could be Rita, thinking, oh, well, I mean, what if you didn't react like Rita and didn't advocate for yourself and you think, oh, maybe it doesn't matter if someone just grabs my butt and it matters. Second guess yourself. That's a huge part of this conversation as well.
It absolutely is. But there is a really strong network of specialist family violence services and sexual assault services across Victoria. Those specialist services will help people to make a report. It's so important that victims continue to report these incidents. What we don't want is to discourage women to report. We want to encourage them to report for our justice systems to respond. And in most times, they do in an appropriate way. But there's lots of times that we hear that they don't. Specialist family violence services.
And we hear it time and time again with how police react to situations like this. Well, we start to see a time, it's a text here from Wayne, and then it says, you know, these officers or police stations should be reported for not doing anything. Is there any follow-up? Is there any recourse that anyone can have to say, well, my report wasn't taken seriously?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be good to talk to VicPol, but you can always ask to speak to the sergeant in charge. Mm. You can always, have a conversation with a higher person in the police force.
But if you feel like you're not being listened to.
Absolutely, yeah. But the family violence services can help to build that kind of reporting relationship and keep it on track and, you know, follow up on where it's at. Provide that support to the victim, provide therapeutic trauma-informed support. As you said to Sarah, this is a traumatic event and, you know, she should be able to access therapeutic support, counselling, look for healing. You know, how do we feel safe again once we've had that kind of a violation?
Helen Bolton is with you, the CEO of Respect Victoria. Just finally, I mean, this is the thing when it comes to reporting and what is taken seriously and isn't taken seriously. There's a question here on text and it says, and I think this would come into the reporting and what isn't taken seriously. Well, it says, well, what is the difference between an unwanted sexual advance and sexual assault? So if you go, like Rita, to the police station and you say somebody grabbed my bum and that's not taken seriously, and yet it is a form of sexual assault.
Absolutely, Rochelle, it is. If you look at the definition of sexual assault, it is any unwanted action or behaviour that makes you feel uncomfortable. Physically touching someone's, you know, private parts is a violation. It is a sexual assault. Sexual harassment is a broad spectrum, and many, many women in communities, in workplaces where they live, play, socialise, work, experience forms of sexual harassment.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, Helen.
Thank you, Rochelle. All the best. Thank you for covering the story.
Well, a huge thanks to Sarah Gibb for speaking so openly and honestly, and we hope that she looks after herself. And a huge thank you to our colleague, Enan Henninen, who brought us this story as well, which is on the ABC website. Helen Bolton there, the CEO of Respect Victoria. Of course, don't forget there is always 1-800-RESPECT, which is an available 24-hour free phone support network. You can call 1-800-737-732. You can even text if that is something that you feel more comfortable doing, that number. And I would recommend throwing these numbers into your phone and saving them there. The text line is 0458-737-732. So you can either call and you can also jump onto their website as well, which is 1800respect.org.au.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, if you went to Melbourne University, you may have passed through a building every day. You may have even have your photo taken underneath it. And it is the photo that is designed by Sir Roy Grounds. And you know him, even if you don't know his name, you know his work because he's behind the National Gallery of Victoria. He's also behind the Arts Centre, just to name a few. There's a lot of really famous houses in and around Melbourne. Well, the Sir Roy Grounds building at Melbourne Uni, which is the John Medley building, may be demolished. But many want it saved as they believe it is a piece of architectural history. Christopher Marshall is a professor of art history at Melbourne University. I don't know whether or not you're standing in front of that building as we speak, Christopher. But it's not as...
I'm looking at some beautiful people taking photographs of the welcome.
Absolutely. So talk us through, explain this building, because it may not stand out as much as some of his other pieces.
Well, he designed it as the entrance point to the university, as the welcome point, and he designed it in relation to the old arts building, which is over the other side, on the other side of the southern lawn that people might remember sitting on, having your lunch on, and he thought of that whole sector as a linking kind of pathway. So you go from the old University of Melbourne, which is the old art building built in the middle of the 19th century. You walk through this lovely kind of open sort of civic space where you can have your lunch, etc. And then you come down some steps, you're facing the city, sort of the outside world. And there's this huge building that was built in the late 60s while he was doing the National Gallery of Victoria and then doing the Arts Centre. And that was meant to be the place where all of the arts academics would stay in their offices, etc. And that's really the role that it's played ever since then.
Wow, gosh, busy. All three projects on at the one time. That's incredible. And so why potentially could it be pulled down?
Well, there's a big master plan. And the plan is to a university master plan, and the plan is to open up this sector of the university, the sector particularly facing onto Grattan Street, and to redevelop it with new buildings, etc., and to tear down this building in the process.
So why is it not on the Victorian Heritage Register?
Such a good question. I don't have a direct answer, but I think the reason might be, in a way, speaking to more, I guess a deeper issue, is that the University of Melbourne, we're all just very busy chasing our tails, we're doing our work, etc. There's not really much of an emphasis on the university as a space of heritage in itself. There's this idea that it's just sort of a utilitarian space, maybe even, it's not a space that belongs to everybody, it's like off in its own little box. And therefore, I think it means that, important pieces of cultural heritage can just sort of fall between the cracks. And I think that's what's happened to this building.
The issue is, let's say a decision is made to save it, and we know sometimes that only facades might be kept, that token parts of the build are kept, and it's swallowed up with the new design. You have to be careful about how you keep heritage, how you nod to its history, but at the same time not make a joke of it and sort of go, oh, well, technically it's still there, and yet everything else that's surrounding it looks ridiculous by comparison.
Absolutely. I mean, my key point here is, it's one of the biggest, most important public buildings created by one of Australia's most important architects. Mm. So I don't think it's a case of just keeping the facade. We've got to keep the whole building for future generations of people to enjoy.
How important is it for the art students, for design students to be able to walk? Because in comparison to some of his other pieces, this is a little more, I don't want to use the word pedestrian. And when I say pedestrian, I say that with love, actually. But it was designed for usability. It wasn't designed to show off and to stand out as such. And that's a lot of his work and his design is, who's using this space? How is it going to be used? And what is its future? And he thought about its future.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, it is iconic. I think it does serve a very powerful kind of convergence point for the university. I think that's why every day I walk out of my office and walk out in front of the building, there are scores of people taking photographs in front of it. Because it has this role as a welcoming gateway to the university. And as I said, Roy Grant's really thought it through really carefully in relation to the rest of the university. But I just think it's become a little bit of a neglected landmark. I just think people have just, after a while you can take it for granted, and there's so much push now, isn't there?
Yeah.
As we all know, for, modernisation and new builds, that we lose track of sight of the significance of our own heritage.
I mean, I like the idea that you say this is a neglected landmark. What's next, do you think?
You mean what's next for us?
Yeah, what's next for this building? Like, what is there a petition? What's going to happen?
We're mad as hell and we're not going to take it. We've just begun to fight. I mean, the thing is, I've been at the university long enough, Rochelle, to know that, a lot of good ideas kind of wither on the vine, and some sort of committee gets a good idea. A lot of bad ideas sometimes, they kind of fall down and into the crack somewhere, and then they kind of, like zombie ideas, they circulate around, then they break out of the ground. You think they've gone, and my goodness, they're still there. This was something that was raised in 2023. We all thought it was this hubristic kind of, planners gone mad kind of idea. And then it just, nothing happened for years and years. Mm. So we all foolishly, as it turned out, thought, well, it's gone. And then suddenly, just before Christmas this year, it burst forth and we're told, oh, by the way, that plan is going ahead and you have to vacate the building by the middle of this year because we're tearing it down.
Well, watch this space. There's already a lot of texts coming in talking about just how much they love Sir Roy Grounds and the importance of his work. Keep us updated, Christopher.
Thank you. There's a lot more to come with this story.
I can imagine Christopher Marshall, Professor of Art History at the University of Melbourne, standing under that building, the Roy Grounds building, which at the moment is earmarked for demolition. Well, from one cultural institution to another. James Young is the owner and booker of Cherry Bar. James, did you go to Melbourne Uni?
No, I went to Monash Uni in Clayton.
Oh, there you go. Well, I didn't go either. I only knew very fancy, posh people that went to Melbourne University, and that's neither you nor me. But, mate, you're known for having some of the biggest stars rock up to Cherry Bar, and last night you had one of them. Who was in your bar last night?
Well, good morning, Rochelle. You'll have to forgive me. I am in an Uber. I'm heading back to Cherry to pick up my car.
Fair enough. That's a big night, mate.
It was, because we've got the Laneway Festival happening in Melbourne at Flemington on Friday, and a couple of the very large artists were in casually at Cherry last night, including Chappelle Roan and Wet Leg.
And it was a very kind of, like, not a lot of fanfare. I know, is it Chappelle or Chappelle? How did you pronounce it? You would know better than me.
I pronounce it like you pronounce Gregory and Chapel, but I say Chappelle.
Chapel.
There's no E on the end, so maybe it is Chapel.
Chapel. I think it's Chapel Roan, yeah.
We know. I mean, to be honest, I wasn't very familiar with her music. I'm now showing my age when artists come into Cherry and I'm Googling on my phone behind the turntables.
Who is this? For people who don't know, she was the one that got her boobs out at the Grammys, so that everyone would be like, oh, right, her. She took her top off.
She asked in the World Grammy Award, so that's a significant feature.
So she didn't want any fanfare. She was just kind of hanging out. She wasn't in the VIP room.
In some respects it was Cherry at its best because it was a quiet Wednesday night. I actually came in after a nice dinner at Philippe with my friend Lawrence Mooney, the comedian. We were enjoying playing music for ourselves, and there were only about 17 people at the bar. And then my manager, Jay, came up to me and said, you realise that's Chapel and that's Wetley over there? And I said, well, that's good, you know, and you leave them to their own devices. It was impressive. There was. It's not often we do see a bodyguard, but there was a very a stern, serious-looking gentleman watching everything on the evening, which kind of was a bit of a telltale. Impressively, Chappell did not go into our so-called artist VIP Andy bar. She was very happy to stand at the bar for over 2 hours. I can report without being too gossipy, she just had a couple of mocktails and was delightfully polite, modest and lovely, and seemed to be enjoying the underground Melbourne, Australian local tunes that I was playing, you know.
You've got a very long list of uber famous that just rock up to Cherry, James Young.
It's true. Personally, I just love it when the road crews turn up because the road crews pay for their drinks. They come back regularly. They tell the whole world about Cherry when they're travelling, and they're back in 3 months with a different artist.
Yeah, so, that's true. That's who you've got to make friends anymore. With. Always make friends with the roadies. Not only will they help you get the drum kit in and out of the car, but they will pay for their own drinks. James, good job not driving home, and we'll let you get back to your car.
Thank you. I'll just mention, because you mentioned Chappell's fashion sense, she was remarkably excited when I gave her a Cherry Bar tote bag. So there you go.
Tote bags are all the rage at the moment. It's all about the tote bag. I love it.
They can carry their vinyl in them. Lovely talking to you, Rochelle. Have a great day.
You too, mate. Thank you. James Young there, who's in an Uber going back to get his car after a big night of Chappell Roan just hanging out at Cherry last night with 17 of her closest mates.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And thank you so much to all of the women who are sending in texts. If you've just joined us, we started the program by talking to a woman, Sarah Gibb, who was out camping and hiking on her own until a man basically jumped out of the bushes and tried to assault her. And one of the questions I asked her is how she's feeling now and whether or not it takes a little while for the trauma and for the reality to kick in. And that led to a conversation around not being believed, one woman's story or account not being enough, and what constitutes a serious act of, you know, violation against a woman. And so many of you saying that, you know, a grope to the bottom wasn't considered enough by police, for example. This tax, it says, Rish, I was groped on a crowded tram when I was 19 years old and it was dismissed by my manager as, well, that just happens to women. Later on, I was assaulted in my first ever therapeutic massage in my early 20s. I'm now in my 50s and I'm still trying to deal with it and to not blame myself for my then naivety. And another that says, so these are hard to listen to, right? Because we can relate to them and you start to think back to things that happened to you and you either do blame yourself or you don't tell anyone or you dismiss it or you tell someone and they laugh it off. So then you don't tell someone the next time it happens. This, just listen to your conversation on sexual assault. I'm well into my 60s now, but I was groped on the bottom by my boss many, many years ago at an event. I was too shocked and alarmed to respond or to report it at the time, but I've never forgotten how demeaning it felt. Such an unwanted violation and lasting implications. I really hope that women are heard and valued more in this generation. And a little sad face that ends that text. And I really hope so too. Don't forget the number if you want to call is 1-800-RESPECT and you can jump online to 1-800-RESPECT as well. That number is 1-800-737-732. It's coming up to a quarter to 12. My name's Rochelle. This is The Conversation Hour. You're on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. So if you're having a shower, maybe you're cleaning out the back of the cupboards and you see sort of something kind of dark and gross on the wall, and you realise that it's mould. Do you know how to get rid of it? Do you know how problematic it could be? And do you even know what mould looks like and the impact that it can have on our lives? Professor Rebecca Bentley is the Director of Research Centre for Healthy Housing at Melbourne University. Melbourne University has had a strong representation today, can I just say, Rebecca? A warm welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Good morning, Rochelle.
So, mould, we think of mould as maybe something a bit gross and green and fuzzy that's in between the tiles. If you haven't been cleaning your bathroom properly, we might think about it as something that grows over food that's been forgotten in the back of the cupboard. But is mould always obvious?
No, mould isn't always visible. And sometimes people can smell a damp smell and that might indicate that there's a problem with mould, but they might not be able to see it. But, you know, certainly if you can see mould, you know, that is a problem.
So what's problematic about mould? Why can't we just remove it and move on?
Yeah, look, it's interesting, isn't it? So the thing with mould is when you sort of try to clean it or move it, you can activate spores that you can then breathe in and they can affect your health. People can have allergic responses to sort of mould in their homes and that can trigger, you know, poor health. Not everyone has that though. So this is the tricky thing about the relationship we have with mould in our homes. But for people who, for example, have asthma or are immunocompromised in some way, you certainly would want to be very careful about having mould in your home to the extent where, say, it's visible, you can see it or you can detect a damp smell. Having said that, some people do find mould in their home that they haven't smelt and haven't seen, and they might move a piece of furniture or they might be doing, you know, something that requires them to, say, pull a bit of plasterboard out and they might find some. So it's something to be a bit vigilant about.
So research now into not only how it impacts our lives, but that may take some time for those impacts to kick in. So what are they?
Yeah, well, the impacts, you know, I guess this is a nice segue into what we were trying to do in some recent research, which was actually instead of thinking about, say, how mould might affect an individual, actually think on the population level in Australia, how much having mould in our homes would impact our health. So what's the burden of health that we're poor health that we're carrying in Australia because we have mould in our homes? And I guess the context for that is that when we did some surveys recently to try and estimate how much mould there was in homes, we were surprised to find that probably about 30% of respondents reported having some mould and about 10% had mould that was reasonably severe. And if you think about that, that's a lot of people in Australia. Mm. So knowing what we know about the relationship between mould and mould as an asthma trigger and mould as something that, you know, creates potentially respiratory tract infections, we then thought, well, we can then estimate, you know, what this means at the population level for health. So the work we did was trying to quantify that, but also think about what that means for what we're paying in healthcare costs in Australia, for mould-related illnesses, and also what we're losing in terms of household income and productivity.
What about in terms of how we actually build and design our homes, and whether or not homes have the right types of ventilation, whether some homes are going to be more susceptible to mould?
Yeah, you're 100% right. So, you know, the things that we need to think about if we were to eradicate mould in Australia is what are the structural factors that create, you know, the situation where we do have a lot of mould in our homes. And obviously that's not straightforward, but what we can say is that homes that are poorly ventilated or that have some problem with water coming in, that could be a flood or it could be through rain or it could be just, you know, poorly designed roof, that those situations create mould and they're preventable. So, you know, we know enough about those causes of mould in homes that we should be building homes now where that is not likely to happen. We also have a changing climate. So we've got shifting patterns of humidity, we've got more floods, we've got more storms. So people might be experiencing mould in homes in areas where maybe, you know, 10 or 20 years ago it wasn't such a consideration. So I think also with our changing climate, the fact that our housing stock, you know, has some age on it. So, you know, homes built 20 years ago might not be sitting in a place where they're well designed for the climate. Or they might not have been well designed at all in relation to what we know now about ventilation in homes and mould. So those structural issues are really important.
Absolutely. And in terms of where we build and flood prone areas and the issues that we have with mould. If people want to read some of this research, Rebecca, how can they go about that?
Well, if you go to the Centre for Research Excellence in Healthy Housing website, we do have a few one-pagers up on our website where we've tried to just summarise some of our research, but there's also links to the papers. They're freely, the paper I'm talking about in particular is freely available on an archive. So you're welcome to hop on our website and have a look at it.
Good on you, Rebecca. Thank you. Professor Rebecca Bentley, the Director for Research Centre for Healthy Housing at Melbourne University. If mould is something that's an issue in your house, it sounds really boring, right, until it impacts you and you realise just how serious it is and just how gross it is as well. This text that's come in from Rowan, and it says, and this is in relation to us talking about being taken seriously if you had unwanted sexual advances. Late to the conversation, but I'd like to comment as a father of two young ladies who are now going out independently. It's just quite disgusting that they still have to be so careful about where they go and what they do. With respectful relationships so heavily instigated in primary school, it's just sad that it's not improving. The fact that this isn't taken as true when reported or even followed up eventually ends up tragically. I know I would act if I witnessed this terrible behaviour. Rowan, thank you so much for your text. So I don't know if you remember, but late last year we spoke about the fact that the much-loved and I think 80-year-old literary journal Meenian was shut down. And there was outrage. You know, people were really worried about where emerging writers would be published, and very big writers came out against the closure. Well, it's been saved, and it's been saved by the Queensland University of Technology. It's taking it over, and it's kind of a homecoming of sorts. Margaret Scheel is the Vice Chancellor of Queensland University of Technology. Margaret, there would be a lot of very happy writers right now.
Yes, thank you. And it's actually interesting how amazingly happy and the people are, and the nature of the people that are happy. It's very widespread. You know, readers and writers actually transcend disciplines and professions. And so the feedback we've had today and yesterday has been extraordinary.
So it is a homecoming of sorts, isn't it? Because Meenian was actually founded in Brisbane.
Yes, yeah, so Meanjin or Meganjin is the traditional name for Brisbane, for parts of Brisbane. Actually, the Gardens Point campus where QUT stands is unquestionably Meanjin, and then some groups use it to indicate a broader area. So we sit on Meanjin. We have an annual Meanjin oration each year hosted by the Currumbra Institute. We have a very strong, a small but really vibrant writing program. And you know, from time to time, people had said it would be good if we could get Meanjin home. And so we were alive to that possibility when the announcement that was made by MEP, and we were one of the first groups to you know, reach out to see whether we could take it over.
So will it change in any way?
Well, it will have to because, I mean, you know, it's the reason that MUP made that decision was because of it, you know, it hadn't been, it, you know, the nature of the journal had changed, the nature of the readership had changed and so on. So we will revitalise it. We're going to take our time. You know, we will establish a new editorial board and recruit an editor, and we'll look, but it's got to focus on writing and literature. That's its purpose, and you know, emerging writers and other you know, established writers as well have all written for MeAngin, and you know, that's the focus for us is the literature and the writing.
So what will the process be now for emerging writers, for example? For those who don't know the process of getting something published, how will any of that change?
Well, you know, obviously we've got to work through that with the various bodies who, you know, so different bodies such as Creative Australia have provided grants over the years for emerging writers to publish in MeAngin. You know, we're talking to them or we will talk to them about that. And then we'll be also looking for other forms of support for emerging writers, you know, so I think there's a lot of interest in MeAngin and emerging writers succeeding. And then, you know, there'll be a normal kind of editorial process of the editor commission's work, and that you know, goes through that process and is published. And as I said, we've got a number of really incredible alumni from our writing program. You know, Sarah Helen Batt, who's a noted poet. We've got Stella Prize winners, Vogel Prize winners, and so on. We awarded an honorary doctorate to Trent Dalton last year, and his graduation address has been like the number one social media post from last year. And, you know, the Brisbane Writers Festival is very well patronised. We've had members of our council have been on the board of that. So there's a lot of interest in writing and literature here, and we think we have the opportunity to create a new, vibrant future for MeAngin.
So next issue, when can people expect it?
Well, we're going to take our time. So we want to make sure that we've got the right editor and the right special issue, but we're, you know, we'll take the coming months to work through that, and depending on when we can secure the editor and you know, it'll be this year, but I'm not giving a date yet.
Can people still apply for these positions? I mean, there'll be lots of people going, oh, you're still looking for an editor.
Well, we will advertise for an editor. Yes, so we haven't started that process. We only took it over on, I signed the deed on Friday, and then we will be, and I'm just in the process of establishing an oversight management committee for it, and then they will establish an editorial advisory board, and we'll commence a search for the editor. But we, you know, we have experienced people on staff, we have experienced alumni, and we think we'll be able to attract a very strong team.
Well, there'll be a lot of very excited writers out there and potential editors as well to hear that it has been saved. So, Margaret, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Margaret Scheel, the Vice-Chancellor of Queensland University of Technology. Still lots of texts coming in about women's safety. This from Doris. My youngest does all of these things. We were talking about hiking and walking and camping and walking alone. She's 23. She hikes and camps with her boyfriends, with her girlfriends, but also frequently by herself. I remember having a conversation about my concerns with her, and she said she wasn't going to let it stop her from living her life. I am so proud of her fierceness. And another that says, I've often thought back to my days of nurse training at a large hospital, and I've wondered how our experiences never made the Me Too conversation. Most of us who had to accompany a man, four lift teams, moving, rolling, lifting our patients, were constantly subject to disgusting comments and touching. It was horrible, but everyone felt they had to put up with it. We complained to each other, but nowhere else. I hope that sort of situation no longer exists, but sadly, it probably does, and that's come through from Ruth. So just to repeat, the number for 1-800-RESPECT is 1-800-737-732, and you can text as well, which is 0458-737-732. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.